Hi. My name is Rick Dunning. I'm the curator of Holden's Museum, and I want to welcome you here this evening, and especially welcome the Miners Reunion Group. These reunions are such wonderful events, especially for the museum. A main part of our job up there is to tell the story of the mine and the people who lived and worked here and what that community was like. And so this is a weekend for me of gathering stories and seeing photos. And we have several programs scheduled as part of the reunion activities. The main purpose of the programs is to jog people's memories and get stories flowing and get other stories flowing and collectively remember what those times were like. In the process, for those of you that never got a chance to see it when it was operating, you'll see some pictures of the community and the mine and hear some of those stories. I'd like to introduce Linda Jensen. She wants to make a quick announcement. She has done so much to organize the reunion activities and has been a major catalyst in this process. So, Linda.
What I want to do tonight is those of you who are in the miners group that get our lovely Holden Miner newsletter once or twice a year from Patty Haddon, I want to remind you that it does cost money to do that, so I'm passing an envelope during the reunion weekend for those of you who want to help contribute towards it so that we can continue to get it. If you are part of the miners group and are not getting it and want to get it, be sure and put your address after your name. If you do contribute, please sign. She always wants to know who's contributing so she can acknowledge them. And I'm going to pass the round at the end of the program, wherever it is. If people will get it back to me, I'll be passing it at the weekend. But I do want to start it and ask you to remember that that's a good way of keeping us in contact with each other. It also is how you find out when our next reunions are. So let's help Patty keep going with that. Thank you.
I do need to apologize for the coziness tonight. Clearly we're pushing the limits of our space. We're here to take advantage of some technology that will be used in the presentation, but it does mean we're tucked in here pretty tight, so be kind to each other and cozy up a little bit more, and we'll enjoy the evening together. I want to now introduce Bill Phillips. He has a great project going, one of several projects that folks are working on with respect to mine history, and he'll be the one presenting the program.
Thank you. Where I'm going to start is approximately 1936. The history of the property goes back way before then, around the turn of the 1900s for the first prospectors. But the particular project that I am working on was to get a picture of all of the residences up in Winston Camp, which is the main housing area that's up the road from us. It's that area that was on leased Forest Service land. And when the mine closed, all of the houses had to be demolished and torn down. So all we see up there today, of course, are the roads and the foundations. So that's basically the project that I started on about 6 years ago, is collecting these photos from the families who had lived there at that time. My family came up here. My father was a mining engineer. He came out of the University of Washington with a degree in mining engineering in 1937, and we lived in various places up here. I was not actually born here, but I was born in 1938 in Seattle, and then my mother brought me back up here when I was about 2 months old. And I personally lived here until 1956 with my brother and my parents, and then we left, which was about a year before the mine closed in 1957. And there are several of us who spent basically our entire childhood up here. This is the only place I know, like Mary Joyce at my front, who can join me. And Mary Ellen, who spent quite a bit of her childhood up here too, and we were all Joe. We graduated from the school up here, went through grades 1 through 8. So it's quite a unique experience for us, and we'll try to pass on a lot of this as much as we can. And there'll be a lot of talk going back and forth. There will be people that will interrupt me and basically fill in the holes of stuff that I don't remember or I get wrong or whatever the case may be. So there was generally a lot of discussion about it. For the people from the mining community, what I have done with this slideshow is one of the people who is with the church volunteers has scanned all of these slides and got together with him to provide a narration. So we put together a DVD. So the mining people, if you have a DVD player and would like to help me review the DVD, I would certainly appreciate them. I don't have them yet. Supposedly they're going to be on the boat tomorrow, so I can hand them out to you for review. And then with that, updating the narration and get as much history as I possibly can onto this DVD. Then eventually we hope to sell them up here in the church store. So with that, we will start with the first slide. I'm going to go through the various communities of residences that we had. This was taken from one of the portals above. It's called Honeymoon Heights. If any of you have hiked up to the main portal, Honeymoon Heights, as you face up the mountain, was up into the trees to the right of the main portal. And right here, you probably see if I can find my button. This is one of the dumps right here. You'll see Heart Lake sitting in here, Heart Lake Falls, Holden Lake in here, and Bonanza. And for those of you who are not familiar with all the geology of the state, this is actually the highest non-volcanic peak of the state.
This is the first highest.
Mount Stewart is a couple hundred feet lower than the Let's get back to you on that, if you will.
I agree.
Thank you, sir.
I approve of that statement.
I must have been mad. Oh, God.
Hi. Slow start.
This is John Blythe, who eventually was the mine superintendent, and his wife, Ruth. And this is the house. Unfortunately, we don't have a complete picture of the house. These houses up at Honeymoon Heights are tar paper houses. They were actually pretty good, but the first houses were actually knockdowns from the original offices that which were at Honeymoon Heights. So there were men's dormitories and offices at that location before the offices were moved down to the 1,500-foot level. This picture was taken in 1936. This is Mr. Ed Haddon. He was eventually the head of the office. This is in Honeymoon Heights. This is a picture of the house, the buildings that I was talking about. I can't tell you which is which here, but these are the original office buildings. This was the Thickport family, taken at Honeymoon Heights, and it's the house that they had built up there. And this was Betty and Don Bickford, someplace down in the town site. And I don't remember where fire hydrant number 11 was at that time, on their ski. This was a group of people who lived up in Honeymoon Heights. There's a picture given to me by the Took family, and the Tooks are pictured in there. I won't go through all the names and everything else. This is Irene and Wilson Took, and one of the houses at Honeymoon Heights. This is a picture of the ladies, some of whom were living up there at the time. And this is in front of the Bly's house. And for those who remember the Clarks, the first lady there is Thayer Clark. Mrs. Bly is the third one. And I don't know if
from which end?
Remember.
Which end are you calling from?
This is the left end, number three.
Okay.
And the lady at the far right end is Gertrude Allison. This is some of the transportation at that time, and this guy is the Cascade Flyer, taken in October of 1941. This is at Lucerne Landing. This is actually at the point of land near where the those homes at Lucerne that Mr. Getty owns. This was the original landing, and in this picture we have the Cascade Flyer, the Speedway, and I don't know what boat that one was. And this was taken in August of 1942. This is Winston. This is the area that was demolished, that was on Forest Service permit land. Originally, there were 81 houses in this area, one burned. That made 80 houses, and then eventually, and I don't remember exactly which year it was, I think it was the late 40s when the 20 houses were added.
I found something that indicated 49.
49? Okay.
I found an old one.
Okay, thank you. See if I can remember that in my... Thank you. Let's see, what else? No, I think it was 19 now, it's not 20. Now what I'm going to do is identify some of the people's houses, and we're going to start at the bottom row. And there were three rows of houses, one down here at the bottom. And it was actually where the drain field is today for the sewage system. There were actually two roads down there. If you go straight up the road, the bottom road is the one that was taken out in the flood last October. There was another road over to the right of that, which was the first row of houses. And then up in the middle row, somewhere in here, there were houses on both sides of that road. And then in the upper road, there were houses on both sides of that road to about here. And then there was a gully in here with springs. And if you walk that road, you'll find a huge thicket up in there.
When were those first houses built? When were the first ones of those built?
I think the construction on those was started in 1936 on the very first one. I'll show you the construction on some of them that people have given to me. This is the very bottom row, and today there, you can see the rock wall, which was the folks' house, which was this first one, and the rock wall is right in here. Let's see, where are we? For those who remember, of course, the first one was the folks, and the Sims were friends. Which is Small's house too, I believe. Rogers and Powell homes are depicted on that lower row. Yes, sir.
When was the village started? Like when did it open? Well, when was 1936.
That's the first construction that I know of. And this is the Small and Rogers houses under construction in. Should have it here. Da-da-da-da. I think, Helen, that was fall of 1941. Does that fall with your memory?
That's right. My father went up there to finish the house without a meeting after the February of 42.
Okay. And I think this next one was the 1942 shot, right?
Right.
The one
right.
You were just talking about.
After we moved up there.
This is on the bottom row, which is about a third and four houses in on that first row.
No. We got into the house itself, not where it's built yet.
Okay. These are the Rogers twins, and we called them the twins. We don't know who's who. And if I were to ask them if they were sitting up here, they wouldn't know. They couldn't tell us which one of them was which either.
I can tell you who's who. Right?
That's Joe. You can?
I would think I could, because I could always tell them apart.
Okay.
They were your class, weren't they, Joe?
No, they were ahead of me about 2 years.
who's who?
Well, I can't see from this side.
Like I said, we always get lots of input and have a lot of fun.
And this is the Rogers house. Now,
how many Rogers were there?
And there was a bunch.
Twelve.
He kept adding on. This was actually the largest house, the most distinctive, three stories. And they did quite a bit of rockery done on here, which I think is shown. Ah, well, this is D.A.'s. That's the father there. And the twins here, I think. And got Gail in here.
Oh, man.
Sister Dixie. I think we have Helen in here, too.
Yes, I am.
And your...
right
over here. That's Helen. And Bill Small here. And the guy in the Boy Scout uniform. Larry Smith. Do you remember Larry Smith, Helen? Okay. This next one is a very famous picture. If the Rogers were here, they would tell us a great story, but we've got the small kids here too, along with the Rogers kids.
The tall ones and the smalls.
Helen, I still don't know the story of why you guys are practicing fishing or whatever it was you were doing here, because there ain't no water down here.
Posing for a picture.
So here's a picture of the wall.
My father built that wall with no cement.
Well, there's Helen on the back side of her house.
Are you planning on eloping, Helen?
And I believe we can't see it here. I don't think it shows up, but she tells me that they had this clothesline that went from their house
over to the neighbor's house on the second row.
But it was actually, I think it was to the house next to ours. Well, the house that we lived in was directly uphill of hers. And she's supposedly putting out the laundry for a drying. Did you do that in the winter, Helen?
Yes, we did that sometimes.
She's got a nice little roof over the and sort of porch.
And it's...
That's our garden.
Your garden, and you and your brother again, right?
Right.
And let's see. Bill shoveling snow.
Okay. Boy, have a little snow.
You can't be a girly man shoveling here.
The early Mavericks.
This is Linda's father's car, and I don't remember what it was.
It was an old Chevrolet pickup with white fenders, and the rest of it was red.
One of the things, we were allowed to have cars up here during the summertime, and the company would transport them on top of the bar, or actually on top of the ore buckets. They'd drive them onto a pallet, and it'd be four-corner bridle, and the crane would pick them up and put them on top of the ore buckets, and they could bring them up. We had to take them down in the fall because of the amount of snowfall that we got up here. There was not enough room to park the cars alongside of the road. And of course, it was a safety hazard, except for a few individuals who were involved because of the mine operations and safety operations. There were only a couple of cars that were actually allowed in the winter time. Okay. And this was taken in front of the Sims house, and they had a pretty elaborate rock wall also. Mr. Sims was our fire chief and constable.
We actually had only one person in the fire department. He was the guy, and of course, everything that we did was on a volunteer basis. If there was a fire, then gathered whatever manpower we could to put them out.
Bill?
Yes?
A piece of that rock wall that still has their dog's footprints in it is now sitting beside the rock wall across from the Forest Service cabin. As you go up the hill, if you were heading up to the ballpark, now that you have to go up the hill, there's a piece of that rock wall sitting along the standing wall there that if you go up, you can still feel the, see and feel the dog's footprints in that wall.
So what did you need a constable for?
Now and then you have to have one. There really wasn't much of a problem up there. There were a few. Some guy tried to break into what we call the recreation hall and tried to steal some money. And I don't know how you could get anything in and out of here, of course. But I don't remember any other particular incident. It was a very, very safe community, very heavily controlled by the time. You can imagine a remote spot like this. This was a Sims backyard. Mr. Sims was a very, very avid fisherman. And this is where he barbecued his fish. This is the inside of the Sims house. This is Mrs. Sims. Their son Pat was one of my friends. Basically grew up with me and my brother and a couple other guys. But this is a typical kitchen of the late 40s, basically. Not much different from anything you'd find in any other community. And this was the Sims family. It was taken around Christmas time. Let me see if I can find a date here, 1950. And you can see some of the furnishings.
Radio?
Radio.
Why?
Right down there.
Did you get radio up there?
Yes, we could get radio up here. We could get stations from Seattle during the night. I remember listening to them. And in fact, I even had a shortwave radio. And I had earphones with it. And so I could listen all night. But we could get stations out of Spokane. And then in later years, there were several people who were actually testing for TV signals. And in actual fact, this valley faces or points directly into Spokane. And we were able to put in a TV antenna and a reflector, and that was used for some time, but in the last couple of years the mine was open. A few people did have great big TV antennas, lots of snow, but we did get I think it was, Sean, was it two channels?
Three.
Three?
Yeah. And St. Joe, Missouri would come in real well.
That's another of the interior. Pretty nice house with a fireplace that they had. And let's see, this was the Earl Moore house, and I haven't really ever been able to pinpoint precisely which house that was. This was taken
on the front row.
Which Joe?
It was on the front row, Earl Moore's house was.
That's so the was house about, that we bought.
That was your house, Linda? Did yeah, Connie figure that out? Okay.
I'm not sure where that was taken from, that picture. Now I'm not sure that's Moore's house.
Well, maybe not. This picture was taken in 1946. And this is Earlis and Earlene Moore and their dog, Caesar. So this gives you a pretty good shot of the summertime, one of the few summertime houses, and starting from, let's see, two was the Holterhoff house on the left, the Evans house, then the Phillips's house, this one right here.
Did you name the streets?
No. Bottom road, middle road, and top road.
We lived in between.
Pretty unique, right?
That was your address.
Well, actually, the roads going up were named. There's Allison Hill and Phillips Hill. What was the middle one?
We lived on Rough Street. That was the one between the two.
Rough Street?
Yes, we lived at 33 Rough Street.
And this is the Holterhoff house inside here. And let's see, that was Marcella Lacey, Louis Evans. Jane Holterhoff and Howard Lacey. And this is looking west in the wintertime along that middle road, looking up the valley. And this is the field house, Al and Florence Field. For those of you who may have seen some articles in the Schlan Mirror and in the Wenatchee World this year, our longtime teacher just turned 99 this year, and unfortunately she wasn't fitting up to the trip. It's so unfortunate she couldn't make it this time. But her daughter Mary Ellen is sitting here someplace. There we are.
Is she related to the Fields?
Yes, her husband Hal Field is the son of M.E. Field, who built the hotel at Stehekin. And Field's Landing is named after the family, and they have a house there and orchard at Field's Point. I don't know, Mary Ellen, maybe you want to add more of the history of your family there at this point, if you wish.
Parking lot of Field's Point with the orchard.
How did World War II affect life in the village?
I don't remember too much about it. I do remember, because I was very young, there may be someone who can answer that better. One of the things I do remember is some of the older Boy Scouts were running around gathering tin cans. I don't remember much in the way of rationing. Is there anybody else who wants to talk to World War II and what you experienced up here during that time?
One of the things I remember is that we were cautioned about if we ever saw a balloon to report it. Don't touch it. They were concerned about the Japanese balloons. Uh-huh. And one of them had been found on the Oregon coast. They warned us about this because they felt that it could be floating over. But one day, there was a balloon up here, and it went all the way through the camp in no time at all. It turned out to be a weather balloon. And we were rationed, sugar rationed. At that time, we were ordering our groceries from Chelan. There was no grocery store. We'd order them from the company, and then they would send all our orders up on the boat, and then they'd deliver them.
Was the mining affected by the war?
Yes, it was affected in that this was a critical industry for the war, and the government was very interested in making sure that this operation continued because of the criticality of copper. Remember, you see all the war stories, for example, of the Army soldiers stringing copper wire, for example. So this was a critical injury. There was a critical industry. There were people here in critical positions who were not draftable, for example.
We didn't have gas rationing. We got whatever fuel supplies they wanted from the government, for example.
There's a newspaper clipping in the museum about when they had a sugar strike because some of the workers in the war were, they went on strike for a short time because they weren't getting enough sugar. The workers saw it lasted just a day or so, and then there was an increase in sugar rationing for here. And I think there are samples of some of the ration cards that Gail Rogers sent up in the museum.
And this is the next house over west of the Fields house in the wintertime. It's too bad I don't have more pictures in the summer, but it seems like everybody took their cameras out and wanted to get the huge depths of snow. So that's most of what we have, and that's the way it is. This is the inside of the house, and this is Al Holzhauser, Mary Joy's father, and Hub Paulson in their kitchen area. And this is the back side of that house, and you will notice the stacks of wood. And there were basically two ways we heated the houses at that time. The Forest Service sometimes would designate places down the road where people could cut trees under a Forest Service permit and get down, or get down wood.
They used Pop and Johnny's to cut the logs up into rounds. And of course, they were hand splitted and then brought and stacked to the house. Other houses, particularly most of the ones down here in the staff housing, were run on oil. Although I remember that our house had wood to begin with. Did we convert to oil, John?
We had wood.
He doesn't remember.
What?
Did convert to oil? And some of the other houses down here were wood.
You guys got electricity from down there, down Lake, right?
Yeah, electricity. We had three electrical wires that came directly from the powerhouse down at Chelan Falls. There were dedicated power lines that came all the way up the lake, crossed by Dunkey Lake, came across the gully at the top switchback, came up the road, crossed the road down about 9 miles, and came up the south side of the valley, went to a distribution center up at the 1,500-foot portal. And all of our power was run off of those lines, all the power down here, and all the power up in the Winston. All the mechanized power in the mill and down in the mine was run off of this electrical power. And then up at the 1,500-foot portal at the left hand, as you're looking at the mill, there were, I don't remember how many diesel engines there were. I think they were from Liberty Boats, or were they from DE's? I don't remember. And that was the electrical standby if we ever lost power down the road. Sometimes we did, particularly if there was a heavy snowfall and the lines would break and that kind of thing. That's basically electrical power. As for other utilities, we had a central water system, just like there is now. It came from Copper Creek. There was an earlier tank that I don't know if it's even still up there now. And then there was the water distribution. We all had running water throughout the whole camp. And sewage was different.
Yeah.
I talked to some people about that. It was a wonderful thing. For those who got my work speech this afternoon. But there was not a central sewage system here. It was basically a holding tank type of system. We did that bring here.
A quick note.
Well, down here, there was a cesspool back behind this playground. The whole dorms, all the housing, what you call the chalet, that was central, and that all ended up in a cesspool down here by railroad tracks.
Well, some of it did, but there was one of the jobs I had was there was also a holding tank in the woods right behind the manager's house down here at the bottom. One of my first jobs was to shovel the duff off of that, and they pulled the concrete lid off of that tank, and then we had to pump it out. And then I think they then, from their pumper truck, they took it up to a hole up in the tailings area. And we had to pump those out. There was one, which was the grease trap also for the hotel, which they uncovered every year. And then there was one up on the lower road in Winston. I remember that very distinctly because
I'm telling
you. Be quiet. one of the men I was working with, he says, never turn your back to the tank. Well, I did, but he caught me in time. And this was in the middle row, part way across, looking west. This is from the Clyde Evans house, and looking down the hill. And let's see, where are we? This gets going tall. This is a picture of our sledders, and I'm not sure because I can't recognize everybody, John, but I think this may be me.
Yeah.
And I think that may be Dolores Hicks. Does anybody recognize these folks? And I think, I don't know whose dog, but I think there's another dog tail. I think this may have been our dog. I'm not sure. But this was one of those, that was one of the sledding.
Let's see. Okay.
Where's your TV antenna? Later here. Has a double Yagi antenna.
And with that TV antenna, this had been taken rather late.
Yeah, that had been late, or mid-50s.
Yeah.
I think the house right here, I think that was the Still family. And later Clyde Evans' house on the left, O'Connor house on the right.
O'Connor's had a TV.
Well, that kind of fits then, I think, doesn't it?
I remember them having a TV.
Okay. And there's a couple of other TV antennas down lower there, too, as far as I see. And you can, like you say, there is an old background. But this would have been taken up in the cul-de-sac area, Mary Joy, where your guys are. I think it was taken probably somewhere in there. And speaking of which.
Speaking of which, in the summer. Well, not quite summer.
Well, close enough. This was our postmaster's house, Mr. Al Holzhauser. And how long was he the postmaster, Mary Joy?
41 or 2 till we closed.
Till we closed. 41 to 57. And that's another shot of that same house. And then see, which of you is that?
That's me.
Is that you?
See my tricycle on board?
Yeah.
That's before we got our good steps going down.
Oh. And that's your father and brother shoveling the snow?
Yep. I shovel it off the road.
And this is one of the things we had to be very, very careful about up here, is that with the snow loads that we got, we had to make sure that the roofs were well shoveled off during the wintertime. You'd be doing it several times. And that included the chalets down here as well. In fact, the very first winter that the mine was closed, of course, there was nobody here to take care of the homes up in Winston in particular. A number of the roofs caved in. On the very first winter, the place was abandoned. That's Mary Joy's mother in her kitchen. And that's looking over the town from a similar area. It looks like from near your house.
Just on the hill.
Was the mine portal noisy?
Well, my brother and I had a discussion. He said it was kind of quiet, and I thought it was kind of noisy.
So which one was it?
Well, I'm the older brother, so the answer you're going to take. The crushers were kind of noisy because the sound was really not muffled, and these were pretty large-scale drum crushers. And every now and again, when they had a big blast during the evenings, you could hear the big blast of dynamite as they're blasting rock underground.
And the fan was noisy.
And that's true, too. We were talking about the fan, and if you walk the road from where the Portal Museum is and the garage, go up to the switchback, and then you go straight out west from the switchback. I don't remember exactly how far, but there's another shaft out there, and the ventilation fan was out at that area. And basically, it kind of overlooks the ballpark here.
That was running constantly?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you had to provide ventilation. The mine operations was a three-shift operation for the entire time that the mine started production, basically from 37 to 57 for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Continual ventilation. There's always somebody underground. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This picture is also taken from that cul-de-sac, and this, I believe, is the freight truck, and somebody was mentioning about groceries. When the groceries came up, it had the people's names on it. As I recall, the groceries had one time or another were delivered directly to people's homes that had bought those roofs.
Bill, do you remember about the coyote holes that they used to use underground?
I don't. Maybe you do, but I never worked underground, so I'm not familiar with the details of operations.
Well, I just remember that they used to use coyote holes in the early part of the mining. They just made a big hole in there and stacked it completely full of dynamite. That was a big thing. And then they set it off and it would shake the mountains around there. And everybody was taken out of the mine at that time. That's about the extent of what I know about.
And I'm not precisely sure where this guy was taken. Let's see. I think this is in that cul-de-sac area also, and I have written down here was the B.L. Ermey house on the right.
So that would be looking up the cul-de-sac.
Yes.
That dark hole would be to their garage, wouldn't it?
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
The dark hole there in the snowbank, would that be to their garage? Their cement garage that they had?
Yeah, that could be, because there was a garage up in that area, wasn't there?
That's that cement garage. It's still there.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah, that.
And that's the Sackett house. And I'm not sure. This may have also been the Ray Miller house. Does that look, anybody remember this particular area? Because I don't remember the Sacketts at all. I don't have the recollection of that family name, which is on obviously the nameplate on the doorway.
Is that, well, that does look like Miller's house.
Okay.
Above Annie Folks, is that what you're talking about? They're on Middle Road, they're around the corner?
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like their place.
Okay.
Ray Miller would run across the street from Bull's house.
Yeah.
Or we might have to look at the map again. Yeah. On that. See where that was. Yes, sir.
Do they have the same amount of snow
now? It was a question about the snow, and I think if you look at the snowfall records in general, you'll probably find the snowfall back in this time period was a lot more than what it is now. And that's generally true throughout most of the West anyway, if you look at the snowfall records. This place was basically no different. If you look, well, you kind of think of about the top house in the circle up here, which my brother and I lived in with our folks for a number of years. I can remember the snow coming up to the bottom of the upper part of that, the top of the stairs. And we'd jump off and bury ourselves.
That would be the Archer's house.
Yeah. The winter of 1955, they had 50 feet of snow on here. And Time magazine had an article. I still have that Time magazine with all the pictures in it.
Life magazine.
Life magazine.
Yeah, Life magazine. Yeah.
And people were digging tunnels and spraying them with hoses to get out.
Yeah, they had to tunnel to get into their homes. In fact, some of the houses up here, I remember that we lived also in the house that's the third one down from the top of the circle. And the snow would slide off and make a nice curly tunnel that Mom told us not to crawl through, but that was an invitation, of course. But the main thing was it put so much pressure on the uphill side of that house that it tilted and you could hardly close the front door. Let's see, this is the Forest Bowie house, as I recall.
It became
the Brogan house, right?
Yeah.
It was built in 1939 by Forest Bowie. And Mrs. Bowie was one of the first elementary teachers up here, too, by the way.
Cistercians.
And that's Mr. Bowie, who built the house with his son. And that's Mrs. Bowie and Alice, who lives down in Manson. She married a fellow by the name of Court Ott, for those people who might come up from Manson. That's the same family. And this is the, who built that one? I don't know. Oh, this was the house that was built by the Embergers. Wilson and Irene took, lived in the house from 1941 to 1952. And the Siskos, where's Diane?
Diane,
that's Diane.
Over here, Bill.
And you lived in the house also, right?
Yes. It was a pretty house.
Oh, yeah.
What year was that? That you lived there?
1939, we built it.
Okay.
And I recall that my dad hauling the logs for that house from just below the camp in a pickup truck. And he hauled all the logs this year up to the site. And they were 8-foot logs. He used an axe to face them on three sides. Every log. And then he hand split the shakes for the roof. When I was up here in 1962, after he'd been vacant for many years, it was still standing. It looked just as good as new.
Thank you. And let's see, this is the interior of the home when the Tooks owned it. During Christmas time, obviously. And you see the furniture, and I think there's a radio on the far side there. It's pretty typical of the homes of that time period. And that's Mr. Took and Marlene outside the home. And Mr. Took was my cub master. I don't know about anybody else who had him as a cub master. Do you remember, Joe?
I don't think we did, no.
You did.
That was after.
I still have my card that he signed. That's Marlene again, and I think in the back is the Wigbers home. This is inside the Wigbers home, and I think this is Sandra Wigbers here, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's Joan.
Is that, I think, one of the Levitt girls here?
That's Joan Bly.
Is that Joan Bly here? Okay.
Sandra's back is behind the other Bly girl.
Okay. I think that was apparently that was a bluebird party. Now this picture is taken right around the Adams house, and I'm not sure if the Adams house is the one there on the right. It should be that one there. I'm not sure. Remember, John?
Because that looked like the Adams house.
Yeah, it is.
Now, what I was trying to figure out is whose house was this. I remember this house with a great big long front deck, and I can't remember whose.
It was on the corner.
Bennett?
They wonder if this one was the next house over. Yeah. Wrigley's lived there at one time.
Okay, that sounds okay. That sounds right.
And then back behind
and then, the Brogan. And you can see the Brogan. Bowie house back here. That's Janet Adams. And I couldn't remember, I couldn't really figure out from the maps exactly whose house that one was.
Massey's.
That's
Massey's. And then they sold the Bob and Jolene Green.
There's your window.
Yeah, see?
Is format going to be all slides or storytelling?
Storytelling will be intermingled with what I'm
doing. Oh, okay. So
it's
No, it's Bob. Guess what I have written down?
No,
I have Massey's house.
No, it was a
Janet's in her own yard.
So you said Janet is in her own yard?
Yeah, she's in the
yard. The road between.
Okay.
Yeah, that looked like their entrance.
Yeah. And I think this is a different spot and a different angle.
Did the company find some of these houses?
There we are.
No, they did not. These houses were put in by the owners themselves. And they paid everything to build the houses. When the house was resold to the following family, it could not be sold for any more than what that person had bought for the house and had paid for additional materials to remodel or add to the house. But that was a rule that was reserved very strictly.
I think House Sound had a $2,500 loan arrangement for some of those houses. I think it might have been the last batch or closer to the ballpark.
Possibly. I'm not knowledgeable on that part of it.
I had heard that too, Bill.
Okay.
Also, Harriet Wilbur said she and her husband lent families money when they were either buying or building houses.
Yeah, there was that. That had occurred. When the mine closed down, the unfortunate part was that the families, the last owners, did not get the money out. The company did not reimburse or provide anything. And this was a source of some controversy, unfortunately. Some people dismantled their houses. There were some actually dismantled enough, and the company actually did provide the transportation to take the sectioned houses or whatever they wanted to salvage from the house. For free, he transported them down the road on the barge to the lakeside job. Mm-hmm. And that, about as far as I know, is what the company contributed when the mine shut down.
The Watson family was one that they took their entire house out of here. The whole thing. And ended up by reconstructing it up in the Tenasquith area. Hmm.
Charlie Rowe did too. He constructed his down there at Chelan, South Chelan.
Let's see, this one was the Ham Handel House, right?
Right.
Built in 1938 by Mr. Ham, and let's see, Hattie, your father took this photo in 1958, is that right?
That's Dad standing there. Actually, Hal Field took it. Dad and Hal and a couple other guys were the last ones to leave. They drained everything, they made sure everything was winterized before they left. And this is the last picture that fall before they moved.
Mm. And this is a Gus Painter's home?
Yeah.
That's coming up the hill on that middle road. And this is Bernie Trainer's, and I never can remember Bernie's father's name.
Paul.
Paul, thank you. And that's Bernie, his sister and cousin. Goes.
I like them.
Love it.
Yeah.
This is the upper row, and you see the houses on both sides on the upper row starting at the east end. And I think the arrow pointed to the home of a classmate of mine by the name of Janet Brown. I've got another picture here when I get to it. Oh, this is it right here. This is Janet on the right. And I think her sister's name is Linda. But, Janet was one of my classmates. I can't remember precisely which grade. Sixth grade, fifth grade. This window right here, Bernice's Beauty Shop. And she was one of the few ladies who offered that service in her home. She had a room in her home dedicated for this service for the ladies.
So people could operate their own businesses up here?
Not really. no, private businesses basically weren't really allowed up here. We did not have all those kind of services. But some of the section was, and I was mistaken this afternoon, I got corrected on. Grocery store was Peter Rabbit. Right. One of the few was allowed to bring in a private business. The other one that was official was Mr. Fred Wickers. And Mr. Rickers had a bad accident underground. He lost total sight in both eyes. And then he ran a sundry type of store with a in where the current village store is. And then there was a post office right next to it. And he sold newspapers, candy, gum, fish gear, a few canned goods, and pocket books. You got a rifle.
Change on.
Sporting goods, fishing gear.
Neat man.
But he knew, you'd go in there, the man would recognize your voice, who you were, and he'd feel around like this. I don't know how he did it, but he knew exactly where everything was in that little store behind his counter. It's unbelievable. He was totally blind.
To me, another great story about Fred Wigbert. He sold our newspapers, and there was two summers running that I took him up to Heart Lake fishing. And if you can believe a blind man walking up to Heart Lake, that's really something to do. And he'd grab a hold of your fishing. You walked in front, and he had a specific way that he wanted it done in terms of holding a fishing rod case, and he'd just trundle right along behind. Absolutely amazing. I did that a couple of times with him.
I have a video that was put on DVD, and I don't know if we'll have time to really show it tonight, but it was taken by another family. And in it is obviously Mr. Whitford. I can kind of recognize him. He's got his usual cigar at his house, totally blind, shoveling his sidewalk of snow. amazing individual.
Didn't he mow his own lawn by putting the garden hose down?
That may be another story, Fred. I don't know that one.
As far as businesses go, my mom had a little business at the back of our house. She sold some gifts, teacups and cups and saucers, and some gift items and yarn and things for the that ladies.
Shoe repair too.
Yeah, Shelby repaired shoes in his basement. Things that were needed.
Interesting. There was a barber shop here, and there's a barber in it. Was he a house and employee?
I wonder
a beauty shop here.
Yeah, I don't know, John.
Now that I think about it.
Yeah, I forgot about the barber shop.
Yeah,
we always went down there once a month.
That I could ask. He came up.
Yeah.
Did he come up? I think every once in a while for a week.
That's what I wanted to know, because I get asked that a lot when I do my summer programs. The barber, whether he's a barber.
Oh, he's here full time.
Yeah, he was here all the time.
Yeah, he was here full time.
Was he here full time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently the guys rule.
Well, hey, John, didn't we actually pay him when we got our hair?
Yeah, we paid him, but I don't know whether he was an employee of House Owner or a private
rent call.
Yeah, I don't know.
This is the upper row at the very west end. The right-hand gentleman here is Mr. Plimpton, and for those of you who may remember Mr. Plimpton. And this is just a friend of his here. This is Mrs. Plimpton, and look at her snow gear. And they had a sled. Unfortunately, their baby I don't believe is in it, but that's a sled that they were using to transport their girls around in. And that's Mrs. Plimpton and her daughter. Without reading my notes, I can't remember. So
Christine or the other one?
One or the other. That's the daughter in the bathtub. This is the daughter, same daughter in the bathtub. And that bathtub, I believe, is still there in the weeds. If anybody wants to look for it, it'd be on the upper road on the west end, down over the hill.
Christine's the one that wrote the study on Honeyman Heights.
Right, she did that as a piece of work.
Right.
Let's see. Is that your house, Joe? Your sequence in here. That's the inside of your house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. By the way, we had the first TV up there. We had the strongest signal when that guy came up here. They're the strongest signal in the area.
And why didn't I go on that? How come I didn't get up there?
Everybody else did.
You got a lot of company, huh?
Yeah. Is that through Crook, Joe?
Pardon me?
Is that through Crook? The guy's last name, Crook?
I don't know the vendor. But I just remember Dad bought a TV.
Bill, let me ask you one thing. I remember Levitt's put their TV outside and set up chairs all along in the lawn so that people could watch. Is that so?
No, I don't remember.
Once in a while, you can get Omaha, Nebraska. That's right.
That's what John was saying.
Yeah.
And that's your dad there, right? When we were probably looking east along that top row of houses.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like your mom and dad.
Yep, that's mom and dad.
And that's your mom down at your Lucerne house, as I recall.
Yes.
I'll get in a little bit on the next sequence.
Two cupcakes.
And what we were doing down there. I think that's the end of that reel, Rick.
Yes. Bill?
Yeah.
Is there anyone here that actually worked on mines?
Joel was one of the people who worked in the mine. Did you have a question for him?
Well, what was it like? Being in the mine.
Don Refnagel probably spent more time in there than I did. He's sitting right over there than I am. He knows more about the mine. I was just in there for just a few months.
Don, you want to talk about underground a little bit and what you thought about working underground? Is he here?
Well, he was upstairs.
Well, I'll tell you, I went down. I never worked. I was 18 before I went underground because that's the U.S. government law. And I'll tell you, I didn't like it. For me, it was claustrophobic.
Oh, that's Shalayo.
Mr. Smith worked underground.
What's that?
Mr. Smith worked underground. You were here in 1958.
38. Okay.
I want to know what it was like working underground.
Well, I worked underground in Oklahoma for about 4 years.
What did you do?
Well, I've seen I did a lot of different things. I started out
minor color eventually.
Yeah, I did some drift mining.
I owed you all.
I was working in an undercut in a stope, and a guy named Coley Smith had more seniority than I did and bumped me out and was killed a few days later in that same stope.
This obviously is a circle, and this is what it looked like back in the time that we lived here. It doesn't look a whole lot different. This is one of the houses on the left side. And again, this is the inside of the Haddon house, and this is the Haddon family. Unfortunately, none of them are here, but Patty Haddon, through Tappan, is actually her married last name. Lives down in Phoenix. So she's the lady who publishes our Holden Miner, which keeps our community all together. But I think the lady here on the left is Mr. Haddon's mother. And then the two girls on the right side are the two Haddon daughters. This was a picture taken during the Christmas of the people in the circle area. My folks are in here and various other people who live down here in the circle area in the cemetery. I won't go into all the names here. This is the Plimpton family and their two daughters when they moved down here. Another one of the houses during the winter. Kids party down here. I'm not going to go through all the names of this setting because it gets to be kind of long. Mike Rogan, wherever you're sitting.
Right there.
He's one of the fellows in here.
Right there.
Oh, that was cute.
The, the Wilbur family. I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'm going to show you a little bit on my family. My folks came up here in 1937. My father was an engineer, although for the first 5 years, he actually worked underground for most of those 5 years and a surveyor 1 year of those 5 years, according to some notes that he had left my brother and I. It was kind of different from what we kind of remember, but I'm going by his notes. There was not enough housing up here. Now, many people were building their houses. The engineering people had, in some cases, had no houses at all, and we did. And up in the ballpark area, about where center field is where my folks had their house, and this is my mother. It had no running water. It was a pipe out here. This is the inside. It was basically a wall tent on a platform. And this is their clothing drawer. That's the dining area. That's the dining room. And later on, that house had solid walls put on it, and this is what it looked like in the fall of 1937, at the time the snows were flying. And this is the same corners of that house. Looks the same. Everything's arranged the same. And then when I was born in 1938, there still wasn't sufficient housing. So we lived down in Lucerne, and Manny Getty's family owned houses at that period also, and we stayed in one of their houses, and this is at the, I believe it's right across from the old Lucerne Landing. And this is the inside of that house, same chest of drawers. And I guess I'm in here someplace. I'll backtrack on this because I want to pick up what from Joe Riggs' house. There were a number of families who actually worked up here with insufficient housing. They lived down at Lucerne, like Joe Riggs' father did. So they had buses running from here, picked the men up down at Lucerne for first shift that started 8 o'clock in the morning, brought them up here, and brought them back down at night. And there were, I don't know how many families may have lived down there who were actually working up here on the property. In addition to that,
there were 42 families on our place at one time.
42?
42, and then the what became the Lucerne Resort was Pat and Alice Lee ran that, and there must have been 20 or so over there.
And then at Meadow Creek, there was a little boat, as I remember, called the Sneak.
Yep.
And there were some cabins. How many people have seen the Meadow Creek Lodge as you came up on the boat? It's on the north shore or east side of the lake or directly across from Lucerne. And there were people who lived in cabins over there. They had a little boat called the Sneak. It was a little tippy little jobby. And they transported them across the lake to Lucerne, and they picked up the same bus, came up here, and then at night it's the reverse.
Did they keep the road open in the winter?
Yes.
Wow. Absolutely.
They get the ore down.
Huh.
They ran ore trucks every week, Monday through Friday, from early in the morning to the afternoon, day in and day out, or should I say every week. Every month, all the way through the winter. The road was kept open all winter long with cats, a snowblower, and a road grader.
What?
Every once in a while, a snow flies and block it, and you have to get out on one side and walk across the snow line.
Yeah.
Somebody beats you and take you on the car.
I can remember one time, I think, John, was the road closed about a week. It was quite
a little over a week.
There was a huge series of avalanches down there, and they couldn't get through on it.
There's information on that in the Holden Miner, and I copied it, and I didn't get time to get it typed before I got back up here. But they actually got the mail through after the second day because the guys were hauling the bags, walking over the slides, and they were bringing stuff up to one side and then carrying it over and getting it from the other side. There was a series, I think, of a total of 11 slides.
Wow.
It was pretty critical because they had to keep getting that ore done. There was no way for us to stack it up there. There was no surplus. Once that ore got down the bottom, it got through the dryer, it had to be loaded in the buckets. There was no storage place really for those buckets. Well, obviously for that particular time there was, but not for an entire winter. So all that, you don't want your miners idle and so on. So it was a year-round full operation for 20 years.
What was the population like at its
peak? Max population we think was a little over 600, maybe 620. And about 400 workers, we believe, at that time.
What kind of housing did the Lucerne families have? Was it insufficient housing or something?
Right at the very beginning, until they got all the housing really put together.
Uh-huh.
And then Honeymoon Heights ran for a little while. I think there was something like about 17 at the peak, 17 families who lived at Honeymoon Heights, and I don't remember a precise date, but it went, they had to shut it down because it was too remote and was also avalanche prone up in there because it's just right off the gully, the main gully that comes off of Copper Peak.
I think they closed the Honeymoon Heights right after somebody was killed in a snowslide.
No.
How many people died?
Linda has been researching that.
I'm working on that. I don't have an exact number. Rick and I think that it's somewhere a little around the 20 figure, 20 over, as far as killed, died in the mine itself, and then there were other non-mine fatalities. There is a book up in the museum now when it opens again. I started putting in the information that I found. I haven't finished, but I don't think they had that many total fatalities for a 20-year operation because they were a very safety-conscious area company. And I don't, from what we're finding, I don't think there were that many.
This was a very safe mine compared to other hard rock mines that you found out in Coeur d'Alene or out in Butte and so forth. This mine had a very good safety record.
But they killed about a man a year.
That's what I recall.
And that's what we think is going to come out. I've been going through the Wenatchee World microfilm.
And this was my family's home up at Honeymoon Heights when we finally got up there, and this was taken in 1938. And this was the dinette area, and our home, same chest of drawers. Not a penetrating picture, right? This was the living room during Christmas, obviously. Anybody like the radio there? This is me on top of the snowstack and my mother out on the porchway. This is Super Skier. This is my brother and I in front of our house in Winston, which was right next to the fields that we had talked about before on the middle row. We lived there through the time that I was in first grade. And then we moved down here after that, but I...
Because it was too far for him to walk.
That's right. Thank you very much. Like I said, you get lots of good help here.
When Bill's mother used to come to the reunion, she said as soon as the kids learned to walk, they taught them to ski so they didn't have to pack them down the hill.
That's about right. I don't have all the houses identified here, but you can see more of the houses behind me here. And then this is my brother and I looking kind of the other way from the middle road, looking uphill and slightly to the right or to the east. And I think the house on the right is probably right on the corner.
Is that Hicks' house?
I think it probably was Robertson's house at one time. Let's see, this guy...
They came off because it snowed about an inch on the 4th of July.
I don't remember that. That's why we have everybody here chiming in. That's
good thing to remember.
Good thing to remember. This is a singing group. There are various singing groups here. And that, This is Mr. Curzon, who is the manager of the mine. This is
Chuck Wilbur.
Chuck Wilbur and my father, Wimpy Phillips. I won't tell you the long story about his nickname either. It's a long story in itself. This is a bowling alley, four lanes back then in 1954. It's got new flooring, and you guys are taking care of that flooring. You're not lumping your bowling balls or anything like that. You want it just smooth, right? Is that right?
Is that the team names in the middle?
Yeah, they are. I can't read all them. There's the riggers and the pin pushers that I can read.
Weren't they put in order in their standings?
I believe they were put in order of standing, yeah.
Do not find that the last is still showing up. Your bowl.
And then the mine provided junior bowling for us kids on Saturday morning, right? With our shot on the way.
I don't know if that sign's still there, guys, but you know, you got to preserve this surface in here. And don't forget that sign right up there, right? Right? Okay. And here we are, the couple of the bowlers and the audience and the seating that we had. And for those of you who remember that some of the people here, like Mrs. Agnes Adams, and people can bring out names of anybody else that might recognize her. Obviously, this is the Women's Bowling League. And this was the ladies' winning team there. And this was Dorothy Rogers, Helen Rogers, Carol Holdroff, and Dixie Rogers. Well, they were married too, so but I didn't give their married names. This was taken in the season of 56-57, which would have been the last
year.
How's that?
Isn't that Gale?
I think it's Gale.
That's Gale.
Are you sure
on the left? Yes.
Sure that's Gale and not Dorothy?
Yeah, that's
Gail.
Gail, yeah.
Okay.
It's like you're out in the
here I go again.
I think Dixie's on the other end.
Yeah, she's just mentioned Dorothy's got the name on that left one.
Yeah, it says Dorothy.
Well, I don't think so because I got that picture from Gail and I think she identified the people for me, but I'll check.
Really?
Oh, it does say Dorothy.
Yeah, it says Dorothy.
Well, it says Dorothy. Doggone it.
Yeah.
You must be right.
Well, unless they change shirts. Okay. It's right there. Evidence in front of us. And that's the men's team. Should be Bob Davidson, Eddie Miles, Ed Elliott, Jim Boyd, and Jim Trent. How's that sound?
Good job.
Thank you, sir. That was the same season as well. Now, this is a picnic up at the picnic area just beyond the ballpark. This is the 4th of July, and 4th of July, the company provided the funds, bought all the wieners and all the fixings and all that kind of thing, and then on Labor Day, the union provided for the picnic.
What year was this, Steve?
I am not positive. I don't remember precisely.
Yeah, that Mike Defoe?
Yes.
Yes. So that would have been in the latter part. It would have been in the late 50s.
It must have been.
Because he was here until the end, as I recall.
Who's the gentleman next to Mike?
Right there? I'm thinking, well, I don't know. He looks familiar, but I can't put a name to that one, John. I don't know. Another shot, and who's this right here?
There I am.
Okay. And this is a pie eating contest. Who's this down here? That should be somebody we recognize. Mm-hmm. So we had various competitions, pie eating competitions, three-legged races, potato sack races. The men had races and they did buck sawing and timed out and that kind of thing. Christmas time, we had a community club that everybody belonged to and provided some funding for, and at Christmas time, every child in the community got a Christmas present. We went through a long line, to receive our Christmas presents. And the gentleman here, I wish I could use my pointer, right here, that's Johnny Akers. And I don't remember who the Santa Claus was at that time.
It's a good picture.
Probably Winnie.
Probably Winnie Meredith.
Before,
what we had to do with the floor.
Yeah, right, Bill was dark then.
He was the son of love for years.
Yeah.
He was a hand Bill.
Yes.
That was 1953.
Yeah, it must have been Winnie. Winnie Meredith.
And this was our, part of the Christmas program is that all the students in the school participated by singing songs. And this was the steps that we stood on, and that's the upper grades there.
How many students were in the school?
How's that?
About, I don't change, but how many students to the school whole generally?
By the end, it was up to right about 120. In 19, see, when I was in sixth grade, they actually had to open the basement. Because John, you were in eighth grade in the basement, right?
No.
Weren't you guys?
No.
In the basement, the eighth grade?
Nope, here in this end room. Always, with Mrs. Steele.
No, we were downstairs for 1 year when they opened it up. But anyway, they had four rooms by the end because they had a classroom in the basement.
Yeah, that was first grade, became first grade.
First grade and kindergarten.
Well, they rotated it.
They had second and third grade down there 1 year when I was in second grade.
They rotated. That's why I was thinking it was there. Because I thought you guys were upset because you didn't get to sit by the window, so you got to sit by the window.
I sat by the window my straight year. You looked over. By the time you got to the eighth grade, you got to sit next to the window and yeah.
That's right.
Maybe it was the year after that. But anyway, they were up to four classrooms by the end of the, by 53, I think it was.
What we're talking about here, you have to understand the pecking order, because when you got through Mrs. Fields' class and you got up to eighth grade, there was a certain prerequisite here. So the eighth graders always got to sit by the windows.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
I went to one other story about
go ahead.
The Christmas presents here at the Christmas tree. The community club played for those, and after gambling was outlawed and the slot machines went away, the kids in the big grades got, instead of getting nice presents, we got apples and collars. I remember that. Because the money wasn't as much after the slot machines were gone, so we had to buy presents.
And donating and tweeting.
Our introduction to politics.
That's a picture of the audience. So what we did is we set up with a stage that's there now. And then they rolled out a canvas, and there were two sheets of canvas that we rolled out across the entire floor. And then we put chairs on top of that.
Folding chairs.
Folding chairs on top of the canvas. We never, ever walked on that floor in our street shoes. And if we did, Brad, what's his name? He'd come down from downstairs and shoot us.
Okay, but Bill, what did you do for the dance?
Yeah.
Well, that was an exception.
Oh.
Otherwise, we did not.
And movies are three times.
We had movies that was brought up over here, and they rolled the canvas down and set the chairs on top of the canvas. We very rarely left the floor uncovered. Now, when we had gymnasium in the wintertime, we're PE, I should say.
The chairs.
We use the gymnasium for our PE in the wintertime.
The chairs are still there. It's just that last year, those chairs that used to be three together all the time, last year they finally took them apart so they could better fit in the building center. But those are the chairs from that we sat on in the mighty days. Those old ones that used to be three connected together, for those of you who've been here for 3 years.
This is, let's see, this was the graduating. Oh, no.
I look a little young for graduation.
These were the school children. We can count them up, but I'm not going to. This photo was taken in either 1939 or 1940. This was supposedly the entire school during that year. This photo here was, let's see, it was taken 1944. This should be Gary Bannister, Junior Hicks, Carol Holderhoff, Ellen Small, right? And Mrs. Bowie was the teacher. She's in the center right there.
Gary Bannister's over on the left side.
And Joe Riggs, are you in there?
You probably, yeah, I'm
on the right. I had that on your list.
On the right side, high.
And John Curzon and Dixie Rogers.
What about high school?
High school? Good question. It was, we had only 1 through 8 up here. Later on was K through 8. Most of the families moved out at that time when the older child turned 14 and completed 8th grade. A number of us had friends, relatives in Chelan that we stayed with, or in Wenatchee. Some of us went to boarding school in Seattle. A couple of fellows went to Gonzaga High School in Spokane. And so there were, Joe went out to high school, Mary Joy went out to high school, I did, my brother did. We were here till, I was here till I was 18. I had completed high school myself and was ready to start college when I left. And Joe attended a year of college while his folks lived up here. So that's kind of the short on that. Let's see, this class.
There's the windows we got to sit by.
These are the windows we got to sit by, and I think this is taken in 1944, grades 5 through 8, and Mrs. Field should be in the back right there. And we have here the Rogers twins, Ruthie Evans, Bill Small, Nita Crook, or Cook, I mean. Patsy Fleming and Helen, you're in there, right? Dixie and Joe and Gary Bannister, John Lee Curzon and Joe Smith. How's that sound?
And the Webb girls.
The Webb girls.
Ethel Webb is in the front row, second over.
Okay.
And I'm in the second row next to Patty. Diane.
Oh. Okay.
I think over in that corner.
And in the, this was in 1945.
It says right on there.
Well,
May
29,
1945. Yep. I think this is when I was really talking to her. I think I've got the annotations back. This is the one with the Rogers twins. I do have, see, the previous one I was wrong on. This is the one with Ethel Webb, right? The Rogers twins, Margaret Trainer.
Seriously.
Okay. This is the class of 1947. Mm-hmm. Bill Small, Dixie Rogers, Raymond, Robert, Colleen Smith, Jean Woods, with Mrs. Field in the center. And this would be graduation class of 1949, right?
Yes.
Do you like that one?
I know most of those people.
Do you know most of those people? That's Joe's class. This is my class. That's myself right there, Elaine Watson, Steve Kaiser, and Jay Johnson. Horror.
And that was in 56?
That was 52.
52.
This is class 53, with Jim Powell up at the podium. And this is Linda's brother. And I'll go through all the rest of the names. This
Mary Joy's in there.
Yeah, Mary Joy is in there.
That's the biggest, one of the biggest classes. 12.
Yeah.
Which color
those
are you
nice dresses?
Six.
I'm right next to Mrs. Peel.
Right there. Are you doing that?
Nigel's right there.
I thought so.
What is there, 9 students there?
Yeah.
I think Mabel. Mabel Blanchard is not in this one, but she was part of that. No, that was 53. I'm sorry. I'm not hitting myself.
Oh, is that Mrs. Field on the left?
Yes, Mrs. Field on the left.
Yeah, it is. This is the class of 54, and this is Mike Grogan's father, who is giving the address for the class.
Is this now when you graduated from 8th grade?
Yes, 8th grade graduation.
Again, you can see what kind of an important formal affair it was.
Yeah.
All that stuff. But
this was not Holden's class of 54. This was the first year that Lucerne was at a school, and we're on one side, and the member of this class.
Oh.
And the Lucerne, they did a joint graduation that year between Lucerne School and Holden School.
Huh.
Lucerne had a 1 through 8 as well?
Yeah, they are 1 through 8 as well. Mm-hmm. And they're on the right side.
So there were 5 students from Lucerne. And
there
are,
I think, 6 in my class.
6, yeah.
Before this time, did they bus up from Lucerne every day?
No.
They had their own school. This was the first joint graduation.
We went to school down there for, they started the school the first year I was ready for first grade because they got enough kids in to get the mine started. And the school was over by in one of the CC buildings over by Railroad Creek. And then the next year they built the schoolhouse that was there, which was, it's been torn down.
When did the school down there close?
I don't. Manny, do you know?
No.
I don't remember. I was gone.
It must have closed when the mine closed.
Well, no, it may have closed before that. I don't know.
Did your mother teach down there? No,
she never taught at Lucerne. That's a fallacy. She taught at Skahegan and she taught up here.
And she taught at Winton, too.
Where?
Winton. Oh,
Winton. She taught a number of places, but she taught at Skahegan and she taught at Winton.
She liked teaching in one room school.
Oh, it was when I was lived in Arizona. I moved down here from here to Arizona. And because they used to have winter vacation instead of summer up there, and she went down there on vacation. And that was in the 50s. I moved down there in 55, so it must have been.
This is a photo that was taken in Mrs. Field's classroom in 1954.
Which room is that?
Mrs. Field.
With the window.
This is the one that's closest to the road. That's the room that had it's generally 5 through 8, some variations. When I started 4th grade, I moved into that room because the teacher who was teaching, should have been teaching 1 through 4, only wanted to teach 3 grades. But they had already hired her, so Mrs. Field got to teach 4 through 8 in one room. I don't know how many kids there were in there, but we were jamming in there. This is Mrs. Field in the background there, against those windows. This was in 1956.
It's snow.
And this was,
Larissa Yates, Sandra Rigbergs, and Terry Levitt. And that would have been my class if we hadn't moved away.
And that's their father's grandfather.
The fathers are standing behind him.
56.
Yeah, it was a fridge in that.
But we were talking about the blind gentleman, and that's him right back here and his daughter. They're all lined up with their daughters. The next sequence. We always had a spring production from the school, and all the kids participated in our spring productions. We did operettas and sometimes singing type things. This is Helen and Bill Small, dressed up as Robin Hood and Marion. This is taken right outside their house up at Winston.
I still have the program for that, if you want to see.
And according to my notes from your notes, Helen, that should have been in May of 47.
Sounds right.
Does that sound right? And this is a production we called with Tom Tom and Tomahawk, which we did in 1948, and I have no idea what the devil we were doing, but we got Helen in here, one of my classmates, Janet Brown, Joe Riggs, Junior Hicks, Carol Holderhoff, Bob Hipshire, Dick Hemphill, Buddy Nickel, Marcine James, Earlis Moore, Kay Waldrop, and Juanette Shelby, if we've done all that correctly. I don't know how I figured that out.
My mother had those all labeled.
I think that's true. That's right. I got it from that's you. Right. That's from your mother. It's a good thing she labeled things. Let's see. The next one. I don't know, John. Should we show this?
Absolutely.
I think we should. This is the Frog Prince.
Oh,
well, the reason I asked my brother up here was the leading man.
Was he the frog?
He's the prince.
He was the frog.
Well, and the prince.
And the prince. And so he had a lot of his classmates in there. And I'm just going to show these. And these are very good photos that were taken by Mary Joyce, Father Al Holzhauser.
That was my 8th grader. That's 54.
Right.
That's Denny Mickens in the butler suit. John is the prince, Janet Adams is the queen.
So you got Rayma Paulson, Bonnie Bell. And you were in there in one of these someplace.
Yeah, I'm over here on the right.
Yeah. And by the way, well, Melinda, why don't you talk about the costumes and the mothers and making the costumes?
I'm going to talk about that tomorrow in my slideshow, but a lot of the costumes were made by the mothers, and a lot of them were made with what she had. For instance, in that previous one, the gals that were wearing, that were the maids, most of us were wearing our square dress outfits, and then the mothers made cummerbunds, black cummerbunds, to make them look like maid outfits, but they were actually our square dance dresses, peasant dresses. We also had a costume box, they called it, up in the guest house attic, where costumes were kept from year to year. Sounds familiar, you're going to hear about this tomorrow, you know, similarities folded. But a lot of these were made. The dress that's up in the museum, if you've been up there before, we'll see again. My mother made that when I was Maid Marian, and we did Robin Hood again in the 50s, and I think that was 54, the spring of 54 that we did that. So the mothers did make a lot of the costumes, and then they would be donated and used again in different ways.
And we all did makeup too, so a lot of the mothers came down. And the boys got makeup, regardless of what we thought about it. For example. And this is another part of the production, and Johnny Akers was our music director at that time.
The kids painted the scenery too.
There she is.
Yeah. And for those of you who can recognize her, it's Elizabeth Taylor and Sutter. But they came up here, did a Lassie movie, took the photos up in Lucerne. So they went to Stehekin. They were up here in Railroad Creek Valley. And this is the Boy Scouts who posed with it. Here again, we got the Rogers twins, and Joe's going to tell who's who here.
You know that film came out on a video a few years ago, and I bought several of them.
Oh, did you?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Courage of Lassie.
Courage of Lassie.
Yeah, when they were filming it, it was going to be Hold High the Torch.
But it didn't sell until they put Lassie.
And this is Lynn Bennett, who was the scoutmaster at the time, and we have Bill Small, who was a cub, and the Boy Scout, we think, is Don Carey.
That's
I
right.
I believe that's what we finally decided.
Dale, I know that Don Carey?
It could be. I
can't tell from over there.
No.
Looks like it.
There's a couple seats right in the front here, Dale. Dale? Over.
Not too many bars.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's much better angle for you.
Well, there's another chair to your right, Dale. There's another chair to your right.
Well, that over there in the corner. Yeah.
Dale?
What is that?
There's a chair to your right empty.
Getting over there, partner.
Yeah, we'll get you there.
That look like, sound like a good identification?
Yeah. It's hard to tell. Yeah, wow.
Been a long time, right? And this is the Boy Scout troop. They headed to the top of Glacier Peak. And I don't exactly know, it was early 40s is about the best I've been able to pin down.
Is that Pack 55?
This is Troop 55.
That was good. The boy got killed.
One got killed on Bonanza.
Looks like a girl's kneeling down there in front of
the...
That's Lynn Bennett, the scoutmaster. And here we are, I believe we're somewhere on the peak itself.
But that wasn't...
Well, I got these pictures from Bernie Trainer, and he was pretty sure that this was up on Glacier. That's Bernie holding the flag out in front of the schoolhouse, right next to the road. This was the Boy Scout group in my era. This is Rich Robertson. This ding-a-ling is me trying to start a fire in the middle of the snowbank. Our scoutmaster, Clyde Evans, and I haven't been able to identify the rest of them over in here. Again, here we are practicing first aid in the snowbank, applying the old ski pole splint, a famous Boy Scout technique, later borrowed by the National Ski Patrol. That's for my ski patrol buddies here. And this is the bunch going down to one of our camporees. Besides having our activities up here, what we did is with our youth groups, both the campfire and with Boy Scouts, we a lot of times joined troops out of Chelan. And the camporees, I remember we went up to Washington Creek and I don't know other various places in Chelan and had camporees for the North Central Boy Scout district. This is another grouping about a year later, and on this one my father was in the center here. He was our adult leader. This is John's group. Let's see, John, that's that you there? Jim Sullivan.
Is that Nigel on the right?
In the front, yeah.
Yeah, that's Nigel Adams right here. They're out on one of their, I think it's probably what, a long-term hike, a leaf hike that you guys may have taken, John, or do you remember?
No idea.
He's never even seen the bear. This is a campfire group with Mrs. Field, apparently was a leader of the campfire, at least for a period of time. And
interesting picture.
Looks like you've got two of them in there at the same time. Interesting. That was a 50s camper, and I think her mother might have been the leader that year.
Yeah, she was on that.
There's one in the chair there over there.
I think it must be at the end of the sequence. Is that right?
Ooh, can we go to bed now?
Yeah. I'll show some of the early mine ones here in this sequence. This was an early picture in the fountain lunch taken from a postcard. I don't know the individual in this particular picture, but you can see the layout and the chairs that we had at that time.
Mary Ellen, you know who that is?
James
Martha Allison.
Martha Allison. Allison? Mary Ellen.
Mary Allison?
Martha.
Martha.
Where was the
Fountain Lunch located?
Same place. It's the same room.
Yeah.
Where the ice cream, where the snack.
Where it would be big.
Okay.
It's a big grill behind her.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes like our family, we come down here, and it's a real treat for us to go down there and have a hamburger dinner on Sunday nights.
Yeah.
And I'm sure other people did too.
The hamburgers were big enough for a meal.
Oh, great hamburgers.
Great hamburgers and great real ice cream and shakes. I miss it. And this is Diane Sisko.
Oh my
goodness. Hey, Diane, what year is this?
Oh, it would be right after I graduated, 54.
54? Okay. I'll throw that down. Thank you. That's the dining hall. That's what it looked like in our time period. And you see the coffee urns, which are still there. And let's see if I have, I don't know how many seated or whatever. I can go through some of the people who work. This is Mr. Curson, who is the mine manager during most of the period the mine was operating. This is John Bly in the center, who eventually was the mine superintendent, but I do not know all the people who are flanking him.
Mm-hmm. I don't either.
I suspect they were probably, could very well have been a couple of the engineers at the time, but I
that's pretty someone, right.
Huh? This gentleman here is Vint Clark, who was a chief engineer for a time, and I don't know the other gentlemen that are flanking him.
Kirk Fox is the guy who did that.
I'm sorry?
Kirk Fox is the guy. Kirk Fox. Yeah.
Oh.
In the middle. Well, they all.
And which one?
In the middle. With, Kirk Fox.
Kirk Fox. Kirk?
Kirk.
Kirk.
K-I-R-K.
I can't hear too
well. K-I-R-K.
Okay. Let's see. Kirk Fox. I remember the name, but I sure don't put it. This is my father. He was a mining engineer. That's him right here. That's Paul Price. That's, Cougar. That's Cougar's last name. Cougar Colgrove. And Bob Johnson. And I don't know, remember him. Anybody remember him? He's in the office. Anybody?
I think it might be Ed Douglas.
He's up here.
Oh, I think I've seen that name on a picture.
Have you?
There.
What's the name?
Last name's Douglas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. His early years.
Mm-hmm. This is taken in the assay office, I believe, by looking at various equipment in here, but I don't know who these people are. Anybody recognize?
That's not Ben Percy on the left.
On the left or the right?
Our left. I don't know.
I was thinking that was Larry, but I was waiting for someone to say. I need to get a hold of his daughter and find out.
Yeah.
But I have a sneaking feeling one of those is Larry.
Yes.
Didn't he run for governor or something?
He ran for the legislature.
Oh, the legislature.
Yeah. This is my father and his mining duds. This is from a picture of my mother's photo album. And John, do you have any idea who this fellow is? He looks familiar, but I cannot put a name to him. So that's typical of the gear that they wore going underground, obviously. This picture was taken when the Geiger Airmen came here, and they got a tour underground, and this is taken in the hoist room, and you can see the hoist and cabling and drum back here. And
that got flooded out one year, didn't it?
That I don't know.
Dale, didn't the
the bulkheads break loose down there? And
I don't think it was horse driven. 1700 on down. I don't think the horse was. Everything from 1700 on down though. With that
hitting was 1500.
That's what you're talking about.
For those of what you are talking about, we measure the footage from the point of discovery. And the point of discovery on the copper was high up on the mountain, and we measure down from there. The main portal is called 1500 foot portal, which means it's 1500 feet below the point of discovery. So what Dale's talking about here, where the flooding was then, was 1700 foot level, which would put it 200 feet below the main portal. And I had some people identified here, but not all. This is Paul Price, I believe. That's my father here. That's Ed Brewer there. And let's see. That's all I could recognize just off the top of my head. A number of the people with their uniforms, obviously. The way they're dressed, they're obviously the airmen. This is in the lunchroom. And let's see, we got Don Carver. This was in December of 53. Ray Yates. I don't know who this gentleman is. But Ray Yates, Chuck Hipsher. Don't know him. John Bull Adams. Don't know him. And Big Fred Robertson. And I don't know who this gentleman is.
What level was that?
The lunchroom, was it at the 1500?
Yeah, that was the 1500 lunchroom. But lots fancier than the ones that were on the lower level.
That was fancy.
It's as fancy as they get. And I'm not sure what you call the vehicles that held the ore and dump. Through the Grizzly, I assume that's the Grizzly rider.
Core car.
That's good, Joe.
That's good. I'm glad he's popping out. And these gentlemen are obviously drilling, and I'm not sure what the scent sign is here.
That's a center line.
It's trying to tell us something or what.
That's a center line. Where do you want
that's
to go?
That's a symbol for center line.
That's the direction they want to go with it.
So it's a real symbol that they use.
Yes.
Okay.
They're drifting.
And this is one of the stopes. It's a huge, I don't know how tall, but you can figure it out. Here's a man sitting down here at the bottom. This is a photo that was taken by Ira Spring when he was up here 1 year. That's a photo of the inside of the mine.
That's one stope that they took all the new people into just to show them. So I can remember going into that one. And that's half full. I mean, filled up the tailings with other things.
Oh, at that level?
At that level. So you're just seeing the upper half of that stope.
Well, some of them were so huge you could stand on the edge of them and throw a rock as hard as you could, and you couldn't hit the other side.
Right.
Well, they were huge. And then you would listen, and finally you'd hear it drop.
Yeah.
That's how big those holes were.
That's why when my dad did that, I decided I was going to go to Seattle and be a mayor.
They were huge holes.
They really were.
That has some special lighting in there because with your headlights on, you had two beams, a wide beam and a narrow beam. And if your narrow beam, you could not see the upper end of the scope.
Well, you could only see about 10 feet clear.
Narrow beam, it's a rock.
And let's see, of course, obviously that's the mill. This is a picture of the mill taken in the mid-40s. And I believe that these are the tanks out here where they tried to do the gold separation.
A finite plant.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's probably a finite plant outside where the tanks are. Right, part of it.
They took those out later on, didn't they?
I'm sure they did. I don't think they ever worked up to what they hoped for. You know? They got some gold out of it. As after they went through all the things, that was just a tailing that we were going to go out. They went up through the used cyanide and did a thing and tried to get some more gold to get out of the tailing. Mm-hmm.
And this is the ore train, probably coming out. Portal is off to the right. Here's the man train. And it looks to me like they're probably getting off the train going toward the drive. And let's see, DA is in here. DA. Where did Gail tell me? I think he's in the center. Right there. I think that's why that arrow was on there. This is one of Gail's photos of GM. I don't know on any of the other gentlemen in here. And there's another shot of the ore train. And it's obviously got a load on it, so I presume it's coming out of the portal. The main portal is up there now. And this is in the hoist room. And is this the man hoist? Does anybody recognize it?
I don't know.
As opposed to the ore hoist?
I'm going to tell from that shot.
Because it looks kind of, well, I don't know, we don't see the drums, so I assume one was probably larger than the other because of the loads they had to carry.
Yeah, the drums. Off to the right.
Ah, there we go. It's a shot inside excuse me. Inside the mill.
Yeah, that's right.
And there was a skip that went up the very extreme right side to haul up supplies and equipment. Here's the stairway that went all the way up. We kids were never allowed to go in there, and you know, you're not supposed to go there, but here again was another. That's where the air was.
Flotation system.
Was bubbled into the slurry, and everything bubbled over, came over the tops of the vats for the concentration process. That's out of focus.
That's your dad.
And that's my father there talking to. And this would be the top of the mill, I believe, looking east. The mill will be down this side and the mountain up towards that way. That was. Oh. This was the sequence of photos that the Union Oil Company had commissioned through a photographer out of Seattle. And this gentleman is Mr. Mallory, and he was the basically the district manager for Union Oil. But basically Union Oil had the contract for all the petroleum products for the mine. And it was the contract was actually administered by a fellow by the name of Dick Warden out of Chelan. But they provided all the gasoline, the diesel, the grease lubricants and oils for the mine. They all came up by company barge, put on in containers that were on top of the ore buckets on the barge. And this is another one of the pictures they took, obviously, of the ore train. Here's the ore buckets down at the bottom. Getting, I can't tell here, but probably loaded onto one of the trucks. Here we got
Bill Clark.
Bill Clark.
Yeah, in the middle.
In the middle, Dick Warden here on the right. He was the Union Oil rep in Chelan, and this probably one of the drivers of either the road grader. It was used to clear the road in the wintertime, and this was the snowblower. And my brother and I were talking about this earlier today, but when the mine closed, there was a fellow by the name of Jim Sullivan did various jobs up here, but he ended up White Pass, Snoqualmie Pass, and Crystal Mountain when it first opened. He was one of the people that helped open Crystal. And I believe that this is the first snowblower that ended up at Crystal Mountain. That's for the benefit of my ski patrol friends, so that they know the connection between here and our famous mountain, Crystal.
Yay!
Well done, Dad, though.
Here's the school. And here's the ore truck, obviously, with the three buckets, each carrying 5 tons of concentrate. Down in the middle of the winter, here's the shot down onto the dock of the CERN.
Go back to that one.
CERN.
And that's where you got the boat to go. We're on a whole different dock there.
But a different dock.
Yeah. So that dock was burned down, and then they built the new one.
Crane used to run out of the dock.
But you can see the crane there, truck. This was a ramp for pulling the tug up off for repair, and also the barges. Did you ever work on the barges?
I did, yes.
God, what a stinking job that is.
Yes.
Someone was asking me about jobs today. One of these was
the barges there one summer.
Did you work on them? Well, what we had to do, there were various holds down on the barge, and every now and again they got to go down and preserve the timbers. So we went down there with Cuprinol.
Cuprinol, yeah.
And no breathing apparatus, no air pump down in there, and they're sending us teenagers like Joe and I. Dale, did you go down?
No, I didn't have
air. Oh, Danny, did you go down and do that?
No.
You get into the way back section where there was no top hatch. Still alive.
That oil had to react with the water in the bottom of the apartment too.
Uh-huh.
And it just made it that much worse. The oil would run down the wall.
Yeah,
it was bad.
It was a real
make you sick as a dog if you didn't let you alone.
Yeah. It was a stinky
dog. And we were under 18, so we had to work in safe places.
Yep.
Yeah.
Safe place, right. I think I was 17, I think, when I did that kind of job.
Yeah, but kill all those worms you had.
You're right. Oh, that's right. And so here we are with a truck, and another truck out there, probably unloading or whatever, the barge. Probably one of the sawmills here, the bucket iron.
Yeah.
And there should be a barge down below there. You can see the bucket right here being lowered down and real low water in the barge down in here.
Okay, if it's built, okay, that's what we were waiting
for. Here's
how many buckets could hold and how fast could the barges turn around and come back up?
Well, depending.
It takes the best part of the day to get down and the best part of the day to get back.
Yeah. It is one day.
Well, no, they do it
overnight, 2 days.
Because I think it was an overnight trip, wasn't it, Manny?
Yes, it was like 20 hours.
Yeah.
Well, Gene Drainer could tell you how many that they loaded out of the bay, because he did that for many years.
Yeah, he did. Where's Gene?
Sitting right there.
Well, there he is, in phone. He's fell asleep.
Kill him, Gene.
Come on, Gene.
I think about 8 buckets of copper and 1 of zinc a ship.
Uh-huh.
That I remember.
Do you recall how many buckets they usually loaded on the barge?
I'm thinking 45, but don't quote me.
Well, it looks something like that number, just looking at the rows and columns of buckets that have hold at least that many.
The barge would way down the water when they loaded.
Yeah, they'd have maybe 2 feet of freeboard when they'd take a loaded barge down, and probably 7 or 8 feet of freeboard when it came back up.
Wow.
This gives you a pretty good count here, because you can sit there and you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And there's got to be at least 5 across, it looks like, in this one, but I don't know if it carry that full weight, but that almost sounds, gee, maybe as many as 60, but I don't know about the weight. One of the things to point out here is to see the cars. They're on this pallet, and they put a special bridle on here, hooked onto the four corners, and the company would let us bring cars up for the summer, then we took them back down in the wintertime. Some people actually park the cars over the winter right there at Lucerne, near today's dock. And there's a bunch of them underneath those trees down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there used to be a house right up the end of the dock area.
Over
there. Remember, right down that right-hand corner? Mm-hmm. There's a house
Now, if I'm saying there's also one.
There was a house right over in there.
Yeah, you're right. There was a house over there.
There was a house just about across from where that A-frame is now that Holden Village built.
Yeah.
Who lived that's over there? I don't remember who lived
well,
over there.
Well, there was a guy named Harry Douglas that was the...
hook tender.
Yeah, he was a hook tender on the barge. And I think Hal Field ran that crane for some time.
Forever.
Yeah, well, he ran it when I was working down there on the dock.
This is Douglas.
There's the tug, and there's the barge. This is in the winter time, so this is right down lake from Lucerne. From the looks of it, I think Lucerne Point.
Yeah, that's the Lucerne Bar. They're right just beyond the barge.
Yeah. Right.
Dunkey Mountain on the left.
Here's another shot of it, and this should be Dunkey Mountain right here, right?
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure.
Did they ever know the barge? No.
They lost a couple hundred cases of beer off of when we were out there with magnets fishing.
And here we are down near the land dock. And I think down, this is the Schland dock, unloading. You can see the concentrate, obviously, in the buckets. And unloading. There's one of the other barges, similar to what's being run today. And then here's the Union Oil truck, and either loading or unloading one of their tanks. So it'll be brought up on the road up here. This is down at Schland Falls, and this is where they upended the buckets and loaded the concentrate into the Great Northern Railroad cars, which went to the Asarco mill in near Tacoma. Thank you. This is the Speedway, and I think this was 53. That's my mother. That's my father. One of these gentlemen here, I believe, is Dick Warden. And I think it's going out during the spring or something, it looks like.
Sometimes in the winter, the waves would get too high, and the water would break over the bow of that, and then you entered just right there where that one man is standing. And the water would run right down the aisle.
Well, this is Speedway, which most people probably haven't seen in recent years. It was taken out of the water. It was put over in Manson to make a museum, but I don't know if it's still there.
It sure looks
But the hatch that Joe was talking about was the only way to get into the bottom.
Right.
And to come out, you had to come out there to get into the upstairs cabin. As I recall, for the history, this originally just was a single floor or story, what do you want to call it, for a boat. And the upper cabin was added in later years.
Right.
And that's Shorty Clark.
Yeah.
And he's talking to the Union Oil guys. Of course, Shorty was in charge of all the surface activities, transportation, and that kind of stuff. That's Dick Warden, and these other gentlemen are the Union Oil Company folks. I want to throw this guy in. This is Old Man Cool. And his cabin of Dunkey.
I have that same picture.
I think it's all over the place. But this guy was basically a hermit, lived up at Dunkey Lake. He lived there year-round and ran a trap line up in the Dunkey Lake area for Martin.
Is that the cabin that Gordon took over eventually?
No, this burned. That's when he died. It burned. Were you on that trip up there?
1943, I think, when that burned.
Oh, were you?
That was up there, yeah.
The Forest Service called.
Yeah, Dale Riggs and another guy found him dead.
It was a hired man.
But they called from Stehekin and saw smoke coming up from down there and called my parents and wanted to know if they'd go up and check on him.
And his birthday was just a few days.
Yeah, mother had baked him a birthday cake and they were carrying that up. And yeah, I think you all went up and came back and said he was dead up there.
We didn't go any further. My husband didn't want us to sit there.
I hired man, I took some shortcuts and got up there about 10, 15 minutes earlier. I think he died from a heart attack.
Yeah, well, that's what everybody said.
He didn't have any twisted thing on his face like he'd been burnt. He was close enough to got burnt something.
He was trying to fight the fire.
Right.
Yeah,
he had to bring water from the lake.
This is a picture of the mill, I believe, right after the mine closed. This is a Boy Scout cabin, which was taken the year after the mine closed. This was next to the last house, which was basically over this way, which was the Watson's house.
Right.
The ballpark was out over this way, and the road obviously went off the site. This is where I remember meeting. I assume you did?
Yes.
I don't know when the Boy Scouts started meeting there, but
I don't know either. Boy, that was one place we had. It was really decorated up with war souvenirs.
Yeah.
That's insane.
But
wasn't that built on a slab?
Yes, and the concrete slab's still there.
The slab's still there.
This is one of the houses. I've got to identify, but I go through these quickly. But this was after the first winter when we were talking about shoveling the snow off the roofs. And even the ones that had metal roofs had a lot of problems. So they did not last long after the place was abandoned.
Okay, that was the Hollingsworth house, and Mom and Dad moved into that. And the reason why the roof caved in was he had the rafters with just aluminum over the top of it. And Dad about died when he found out.
And the house was here. You see, here's a collapsed roof from back porch, I believe, from the looks of it. This roof is completely gone. And this is the folks' house. This is the one that was on the corner. But you notice all the foliage around here, the green grass is no longer there. It looks
like on the top row, up there close to where I used to live.
I think probably was.
It looked like it.
Yeah. That's the Sims house, and that's Tootie standing right here. So there he's calling. That's the Holzhauser house, and the deer is down by. And that's that sequence. And Linda, I don't think we have time to show the DVD tonight, do you?
No.
Bill, let me ask one thing to get the whole village community. Because my first understanding when the village had the offer of not only Townsite, but they also had the offer of Winston Camp, and it was too much to take on. And that's the main reason the Forest Service said, okay, we're going to go. So Holden Haddock's first crack at it. Did you ever?
I have not heard it.
I don't think that's correct.
I wouldn't be able to confirm that.
I think Winston had already been burned down by the time when the Lutheran.
61?
63 it was burned.
Yeah, well, they took it over in 61. Yeah,
but the company couldn't offer those buildings because the company didn't own those buildings. Yeah. So they couldn't offer them anyway. But the Luthers did send us letters asking us if we wanted to donate our houses, and some people did.
Unless anybody else has anything to add, that's
good job.